Well, welcome to the Carnival of Bastards. I'm St. John Karp.
And I'm David Innes.
And we're back from a little hiatus without even producing a charity single, I'm glad to say.
Oh, yes, there's no chubby, sausage-fingered rage from this side of the pond, let us assure you.
Well, I'm not sure we have chubby, sausage-sized Doctor Who fans in America. Oh, wait.
Ha! See, wait, get yes. That audience? Satire.
Well, Ian Levine is going to be at the top of our list of things to talk about today.
Oh, how delightful.
For at least three reasons. Mm. I mean, one, he officially has the new Planet of Giants reconstruction out on DVD.
Does he?
Have you not heard about this? Oh, God. Well,
no, I'd heard vaguely about it, but my question is why?
Because I read about this. They actually filmed episodes 3 and 4 of Planet of Giants, then decided it was crap, and they edited them down into one episode, and the cut material no longer survives.
Right.
So there is actually missing official Doctor Who material that they decided they needed to reconstruct.
Uh-huh. So when you say it's out on DVD, are we talking like I can go to my local ABC shop and get it, or...?
Yeah, the official Planet of Giants DVD release. It hasn't been released in America yet, so I haven't seen it. But I believe it's out in region, 2 and 4?
Oh, so that actual Planet of Giants DVD does have this nonsense attached to it.
Yeah, I believe so. It's official.
What's the point?
Because it's reconstructing missing actual stuff. And I think they've got... I think they actually got Caroline Ford and William Russell and got, you know, the ghost of Richard Herndale to do the First Doctor.
Look, I'll stay on this point right here. Look, Ian Levine doesn't really bother me. I can tell.
No, I like him.
I'm not a fan of him, but you know, he has done at some point reasonable work. He's gone and found
missing
episodes.
We're not counting Doctor in Distress here.
No, I'm not counting that, but. I'm not that fazed by him, to be honest, primarily because so many people get worked up about him, and he has this wonderful attitude that he's made so many enemies and things like that. Well, you know, if he's got squillions of pounds to spend on nonsense, then good on him.
He has made enemies, though, and I think it's his attitude that if anyone even slightly disagrees with him, he absolutely flips out on them, which I can understand from, like, an Asperger-y standpoint, but... he seems to go out of his way to be a cock about things, even when he's doing good work and he's on the side of right.
It doesn't help that he's also got lots of money. Generally, people with lots of money aren't exactly going to be like, hooray, please be my friend for genuine reasons.
Oh, well, that's true. He also seems to have massively overstated his part in recovering missing episodes. I understand what he did, and I understand that he did a lot, but... He seems, in his podcast recently, seems to have claimed responsibility for returning more missing episodes than were actually missing in the first place. I don't know where his math is coming from.
Of course, that particular statistic, thanks to Philip Sandifer and his excellent blog.
His Twitter, at least. No, I looked up the number of missing episodes on Wikipedia, and they said 41. And is it true Levine claimed he found 53?
Probably at this point I was listening, though, just to make it clear, there was a particular podcast and an interview with Ian Levine.
For listeners, we should actually tell them who the hell Ian Levine is. I'm not sure that many people know.
Oh, yeah. That may be helpful. I don't know. All right.
So, oh, yeah, audiences.
As if. People know. People know who.
Ian Levine seems to be the guy they invented the term Uberfan to describe.
Yeah, well, basically, thanks to his rather privileged upbringing and whatever else, he was able to get access to visit the BBC and whatever else, and primarily wanted to go and get recordings of various Doctor Who episodes, and he was able to, amongst many things, he's most noted for saving the entirety of the Daleks, which otherwise would have got junked, which is all delightful. But because he was known at the BBC for buying these tapes and whatever else, John Nathan Turner had spotted him and became a sort of an unofficial continuity advisor, in other words, anorak on the phone, in order to boost continuity references in Doctor Who and say,
well,
to
I,
save
I
them
I gather
time.
He had them all on audio tape and had them all transcribed and annotated with pictures so that if some issue of continuity came up or if they wanted to make a reference to old Doctor Who, older Doctor Who stories, he just, you know, whipped out his audio tapes and he could tell them anything off the top of his head.
Well, yeah, well, he knew most of, you know, anything like that, and especially at that particular era, JNT was most interested in being able to put as many continuity references to say, hey, we're still, like, the old stuff, we're nowhere near as crap.
Which is a terrible idea from a writing standpoint and audiences, because it's great if you have, you know, clips from old Doctor Who and reveals of old villains, but just shoehorning as many continuity references in as you can, like JNT did, sort of alienates a lot of fans and they won't get it. And it's part of what I don't like with Moffat as well, that his plot arcs that span over the course of a year mean that you have to have watched every single episode and have a photographic memory of what's gone on before.
Yeah, well, then again, to be fair, we had that with Bad Wolf and whatever else beforehand.
Oh, no. Bad Wolf was constructed in a way that you didn't need to have seen absolutely everything before it. But Moffat's Doctor Who now is done in a way that it makes no sense unless you've seen the previous 10 episodes.
I guess so.
It's a fine balance.
Although The End of Time also does that too.
Moffat's taken it and made it worse, I think. Russell T. Davies had a good sense of balance where there was enough continuity that the really hardcore anoraks could go, oh my god, yes! Oh, I need a change of pants.
And
mainstream audiences who just sort of tuned in every now and then on a Saturday could watch it and go, oh yeah, stuff's going on.
I like the fact that a lot of people are really passionate about television in your impressions.
Oh, it's just my impressions. Come on, go on. Let's hear your side of things.
Well, I imagine it's more a case with fans, it's... And with average viewers, it's...
Okay, so in your worlds, television viewers actually don't have language.
That's correct. They're
grunting at their sets going... like Exelons.
That's exactly it. I mean, wasn't that one of the... predictions of television would destroy, you know, books and reading and learning.
And it has.
Precisely. But anyway, I forget where this tangent was leading us. It was something about...
We started with David Levine and Planet of Giants. Ian Levine. Who the hell is David Levine?
Clearly his lesser-known brother, who was maybe
the
involved
supermodel.
In a supermodel and may have retired to open up a small pottery farm.
Well, we started with Ian Levine and Planet of Giants. There's also his Sharda, and I have a suspicion that Ian Levine went out of his way to reconstruct Sharda, one of the Doctor Who stories in the 70s that was started to be made but cancelled halfway through production, which is absolutely tragic because it stars pretty much the most popular Doctor and one of the most popular writers who's worked on Doctor Who. It was written by Douglas Adams. So it's always been a great... you know, injury to fans that it was never made. Ian Levine has gone and reconstructed it on his own with the original actors, except Tom Baker, I think.
Yeah.
And then tried to sell it to the BBC and say, hey, just put this out on DVD. And the BBC said, no.
Well, yeah.
I don't blame him for that, but I think the reason that the BBC has declined is probably that they've got their own charter plans in the works.
Well, there is quite possibly that. I mean, more often than not, they'll probably do... they'll be releasing it themselves, and they might do the like what they've done with the Reign of Terror. They might do animations or something like that in between.
Yeah, and the Invasion. I reckon they'll either do animations or they'll release it with the two newly discovered episodes from the Second Doctor, one from the Second Doctor, one from the First Doctor.
Well, that would be crap.
Well, I thought there'd be some kind of missing release with lots of. You know, lost episodes, because it's too late for them to appear on the Lost in Time box set, isn't it?
Yeah, although they might release the Lost in Time box set. Now, the reason why I dislike that is that Sharda doesn't really have missing episodes. It has one full episode, and then bits of others.
Well, it's not missing per se, but it was... It's a loss from the Doctor Who canon that really should have been there.
Mm. Well, yeah. Exactly.
I don't agree.
You're taking my point and putting it in proper terms, whereas I'm just going, it's a thing with a thing. So,
but it's Douglas Adams, and I think it's a magnificent script, actually.
I will grant you, it is actually quite enjoyable in all the versions that I've seen. I've seen the old 90s VHS release.
Oh, yes. Oh,
beat
yes.
Beat you, cock.
I'm sorry, beat you, cock?
Don't you remember Tom? Because in the VHS release, Tom Baker is doing all the narration in between the scenes that were actually filmed.
Is there something he says to a dead Cyberman?
I think something like that. He's talking about all. He's walking past all these monsters that he's defeated, and pretty sure it's a Cyberman that goes, beat you, cock.
Well, hang on. I remember in The Rescue, Ian says something like, we'll take care of this cocky licking or whatever his name is.
Oh, is that? I thought that was a Billy Fluff that he
deliberately
did.
Swear to God, it was Ian, because he's acting all macho and, you know, James Bond, and don't worry, woman, we'll take care of it.
Well, quite possibly. I know that the cocky licking was mentioned at some point.
Oh yes, no, there was definitely a lot of cocky licking in that story.
Oh, definite excessive amounts.
Any other good swearing that actually slipped into the old series?
Any good swearing?
Yeah, any other good, fucks or shits or cocks that managed to work their way in? I'm sure there was one.
Well, there's the interpretation that when in the chase, when Vicky's bothering everyone, and the Doctor's trying to fix the space-time visualizer, he's got like a screwdriver in his mouth or a spanner in his mouth while he's trying to fix things, and he's going, "Murr!" Some people have interpreted that he's actually really horrendously swearing with it. Basically going, "Hey, fuck off!"
That's not fair. You can't hear what he's saying at all. You could just make something up.
Yeah.
Unicorns for presidents, you know.
I don't know, I'm just saying that's an interpretation. I don't think there's any way that anyone would, because with the scrupulous checking by the BBC, I don't think there's any swearing ever involved anywhere.
I think there are some mumbles that sort of slip in.
I honestly don't know.
Where's
might
the
have,
goddamn
might have
discontinuity
check the
guide
bloopers
when you need it?
Archive. What?
The bloopers archive. The discontinuity guides tends to be pretty good about this sort of thing.
Oh, well, check them. that would probably be the
yeah, check best them.
Source.
Why are you talking to me? Go
yeah,
read
I know,
your
right?
books.
Yeah. Nerd. But yeah, so, Ian Levine has made The Shadow, which I have to admit, slightly curious about.
I'd love to see it. I actually think it's really good. I'm inclined to believe that it's really good.
So that I've heard, and I'm now more curious about this Planet of Giants. I must go and purchase it and see whether or not it is worthwhile, to do. Yes.
I'm surprised you've been this slow off the mark. It's been on the top of my to-do list for the last month, but it doesn't come out here till what? What's the next month after this one? September. Yeah, that's the one.
I just honestly haven't really cared. that's probably why. I'm not a Hartnell person. I'm not a
don't
Hartnell
care.
Person.
Not a Hartnell person. Who are you?
Same person you always known. Or I'm maybe a muffin
convinced.
With a mustache.
Oh god, you don't have a mustache again, do you?
I always have a mustache. When have I not had a mustache?
You were clean shaven when I first met you.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Oh yeah, I didn't have a mustache that time. I didn't have a mustache.
Yeah. Those crazy days.
Yeah, take that.
I know, right?
Anything else? I mean, any other recent DVD releases that have caught your attention?
Honestly? No. I'm more sort of astounded more about that, and I should look that up. Because the thing is, I occasionally purchase DVDs, and then I get horribly disappointed because the extras aren't all that great, or I don't learn much. Like, I still think the only great DVD release that was worth every cent of my, you know, hard-earned money was the Trial of a Time Lord box set.
Oh, are you serious? Why?
Because the documentaries on there, I learnt more than I'd ever knew. It was a really great indication of what happened in the era, and everyone got to have their say, and I learned a lot more. Because normally what's happened whenever you've documented the whole cancellation or whatever it was that led up to Trial of Time, or that sort of the hiatus period, there's always, you only ever hear one person's opinion at a time, but this was a great instance to have everyone's opinions all at once, so you could start sort of chopping and changing and whatever else, and you can hear, get a sort of broader picture. I'd only up to this point only ever heard when I use, oh sorry, when I say heard, I mean read, sort of, when the DWM used to do, Doctor Who Magazine used to do their pieces or interviews with people, and there was like interview on Eric Saywood, and there was the interview with Gary Downey, and they were all sort of supposedly controversial and whatever else. And that was the only thing I'd ever really read or researched about that period. And then seeing this wonderful documentary, it was just awesome. And also, it was, that's why I particularly liked it more than anything else. Whereas I find most documentaries on that have been available are all a bit weak. They're all like, yes, we didn't have much money those days. Ah, yes, there was a thing with that guy. Ha yes.
They're not brilliant. Like, they're not completely interstellar, but you do learn something, and it's nice to hear the actors talk.
Well, yeah. Well, let's take, for instance, a recent box set I bought, which was The Ace Adventures, primarily because it has one of my favorite episodes of all time, The Happiness Patrol.
Hey!
In it. And, again, watching the documentary, I didn't really learn much from that.
I watched the DVD of Happiness Patrol a month or two ago, and it's still a really good story, but it seems badly constructed because it keeps cutting back and forth between very short scenes that don't really connect to one another. So it makes you feel very disconnected and it doesn't engage you as much as it should. I think it could have benefited from a slightly more coherent storyline.
I will strongly disagree. I think that the way it's put together keeps it, well, the reason what the cuts is what keeps it moving, and I still think that there is a strong storyline, because you're watching it not necessarily because it's some sort of well-written space opera, it's more the fact that it is a social, political satire of things, and it's a great overarching concept of a place where it's illegal to be happy. Or sorry, yeah. Illegal to be sad, rather.
Illegal to be unhappy. No, yeah. I appreciate the Margaret Thatcher thing. I don't particularly care, but I understand that it's there. I think it's better as a more general comment on society rather than about Margaret Thatcher's society.
I don't think it's necessarily... I mean, that was only more for an interpretation of character, the documentary.
Right.
But to me, I appreciate it for the fact that it is basically representing Britain of the time. We got those wonderful marches. You got the fact that it is illegal to be unhappy, and that's that sort of thing. It's very much that idea of people going against unions or whatever else. It's illegal to go on strike or whatever else. It's illegal to complain about work, that sort of thing. And this was coming from a time where the government in Britain was taking a huge big stranglehold on what unions could do. In fact, only a few years earlier than that was the classic bringing in the military to make the miners work, you know, that's to break up the miners' strike. So within that, within reasonable history, this is an excellent place. And I just love it, because I love the fact that there is that satire, but there's a great bit of fun with the Candyman. I love the Candyman. And also the other thing, I think why I draw to stories because of characters, and I think that's why I like this. I'm not a story person, I'm a characters person. Also, when I say I am a story person, I'm not an narrative person, because I believe strong characters build a good narrative, rather than, you shouldn't have a narrative where characters are forced to, you know, make the narrative work. The narrative should be what happens when you've got strong characters. So this did, and it was just, it's just a joy to watch. It's a joy, and the music is magnificent in it.
Yes, it is. I gotta confess, it took me a while to come around to this story, because my memories of it from childhood were just that it was excruciatingly painful. The Candyman was awful. Painting the TARDIS pink was shit. And it's taken a couple of watchings to come round to it and realize how good a story it is.
That's really interesting, because I loved it from day dot. I really did. When I first watched it, when I first bought the VHS, I loved it. I really did. And I still do. I think.
Well, yeah, but you've been, you know, paying taxes and shaving since you were six.
Yes, that's exactly right. When I was released from my nappies, I was able to put on my bowler hat and pinstripe suit, and I went down to, you know, Johnson & Johnson's accountancy firm.
I've talked to you about the more adult Doctor Who stories that you only really get when you've matured a bit, like The Sunmakers, which I, again, didn't like the first time I saw it. I thought it was a bit dull. But when I've watched it in my adulthood, I've realized, oh my god, this is incredibly brilliant and clever and funny. And again, I see you at the age of, you know, 7 or 8 going, ah, yes, oh, don't taxes and bureaucracy suck.
Because, yeah, well, of course I did that. No, funny enough, the first time I watched The Sunmakers would have been when was I starting to tape them from UK TV? I would have been probably in year 10 or year 11.
Oh, were you a cable TV boy with your UK gold?
Well, UK TV, that's the Australian one.
Beg your pardon. I'm sorry.
My pardon has been given to you?
Yes. We who grew up without cable television, without Doctor Who broadcasts, had to try and scam them off friends or else shell out our hard-earned pennies to buy a $30 VHS from the shop.
Hang on. Are you criticising my
privileged upbringing?
Considering you went to, you know, Lord Arsington's school for shits, you know.
Hogwarts. It's called Hogwarts.
You went to Hogwarts school in Sydney. You know. Yeah, take that. Look at that hard-hitting retaliation. Ah, I'm totally hurting you.
Speaking of class snobbery, every time you mention minors, and it comes up a lot in Doctor Who because there are lots of stories where, war, I'd be working down the pit. That kind of crap.
Good impression.
And miners' strikes, which were very political at the time, I just turn off. I don't care about miners.
And I think we're clearly referring to the Monster of Peladon here as a primary example.
Yeah, well, Monster of Peladon, the Green Death, Mark of the Rani. Miners, bloody miners keep coming up.
I actually quite like Mark of the Rani primarily because I just think it's a reasonable story with excessive verbosity in its dialogue. I actually don't mind it. Mainly because I think as the inner child nerd, I was so excited by the Rani's TARDIS.
But I couldn't finish it. I tried watching it again just recently, got one episode in, and just, I didn't care.
Okay. Oh, no, well, it's a fair thing, because it's very diluted. I mean, there's no point for Anthony Ainley's character to be there.
He sort of prances around, and These godlike, all-powerful Time Lords seem to come down to, you know, I nicked your test tube, blah, blah, blah.
Well, that's the thing. When you've got three people who are of equal status and equal power, you got to get that sort of squabble. I actually quite enjoyed it. But Monster of Peladon is a complete waste of time.
Yes.
That goes and forever that to as me well. It's like is six not episodes, even just the fact that it's Miner's Strike. That's just because it's long-winded repeat of Curse of Peladon, and it's just and that season has a horrible fact of right. Yes, we're the establishment of the BBC. We need to write about feminism. I know we're going to make our feminist character spout a whole bunch of feminist things. That's exactly what feminists do. Yes.
Now look here. There's nothing only about being a girl.
Sorry, I just
because the best people, the people best qualified to write about women and feminism, are middle-aged white men who've been in their industry for the last 10 million years.
Precisely. Oh, it's painful. So very painful. The thing is, Sunmakers, when I first watched it, I didn't enjoy it. I thought it was tedious or whatever else. That was definitely a story that I needed to rewatch. So, yes, even though I may be mustachioed and bowler hatted at the age of 7, I didn't quite appreciate it until much later. In fact, I actually didn't watch Doctor Who at the age of 7. I was watching Doctor Who from the age of 9 on.
Slow starter, were you?
Yes, 9 onwards. I was part of the video generation, man.
Oh, yeah, me too.
There.
Take well, we're that. On the... take that, privileged people who grew up in the 80s.
I know, right?
What's the point of view, huh?
Exactly. You and your bloody long lead exhibitions and your, you know, smashing your TV sets for publicity.
And we're back to Ian Levine.
Well,
this time. It was entirely your fault.
But, look, good on him for, you know, being passionate about something.
I'm all for it, but, you know, grr, doctor in distress, now I'm going to smash my television.
But to be fair, decisions like Doctors in Distress were not started by Ian Levine.
If you listen to his side of the story, at least he had nothing to do with it and was just made to promote it.
I was just thinking it was more a case of... I think he produced it, but other people created it. But it was more the case of that was a drunken idea in the middle of the night with John Nathan Turner and Gary Downey.
I think all of JNT's ideas were drunken ideas. Didn't he die of, you know, liver explosion?
I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure that could have been possibly it. But to be fair, though, a lot of people... I'm also one of these fans that don't slag off JNT, because, you know, he... No matter who you had there, if it wasn't for John Nathan Turner, probably would have been cancelled earlier. He was the only one that was going to take that job. It was already a dying ship with Graham Williams. No one else really wanted to take it on, so...
Well, hang on, dying ship. Are we talking about late Tom Baker period here?
Yeah.
That's not dying ship. I mean, it may not have been at the peak of what it was before, but, you still had some of the best writers and best actors to work with.
I'm not talking about the quality of show. I'm talking about how it was seen in the BBC eyes, because ratings, apart from City of Death, which the only reason why I got its ratings is because... all the other channels spontaneously went out at that time. But if you look at the ratings were low. The audience appreciation figures were low because basically it was just getting silly and ridiculous and cheap. It looked cheap and nasty. It looked exactly what it was.
That just means they needed a good producer because the production team changes all the time and Doctor Who had been cheap and nasty before and it'll be cheap and nasty again. But and to put someone who is... so totally awful in the position that they, put question marks on people's lapels and hired Peter Davison and made the Sixth Doctor a complete cunt.
Yeah, but the thing is, at that time, you say it's an in-new producer, but no other producers were coming into the fold. Nobody else. John Nathan Turner was seen as a fresh face in the industry, and the reason why... See, the thing is, I still think some of the stuff he did was important. The fact is that when he came in, the entirety of the look of the show, the feel of the show, was changed, and it was needed. It gave it a big jolt in the arm. If you had watched from the end of Horns of Nymon right to the start of Leisure Hive, it's completely different. Sure, there's a lot of arsing about with some of the visuals. And sure, it is a problem when your producer doesn't come from a writer's point of view, but rather comes from, PR... history, you're not going to get a terribly good show. I mean, that's the reason the success of the most recent series of Doctor Who is because they've got head writers. You've got an executive producer who comes from a writing background, not from like a, I know what we need to do, we need to go and advertise this in the local newspaper sort of attitude. However, having said that, it was the jolt it needed.
Well, I think that approach worked with Russell T. Davies. I don't think it's working with Stephen Moffat so well. He's good at the writing. He can do that. But at the production and directing the where the show is going, not so much.
Well, I just don't think... I think it will take a while, but he's not very good at rewriting other people's scripts. But, I mean, that's also just a different style. Like, Russell T. would completely rewrite people's scripts.
Which must have been quite painful for the other writers, but it did result in a generally good high quality of show.
But that's the thing, that's why I think the end justifies the means, because for me, if I was a writer and I wrote this script, I think in the end I would be happy for it to be written, because I'm only seeing it from my episode's point of view. The head writer is seeing it from the entire series point of view. So yes, there might be a bit of preciousness of a dialogue bit being cut out or whatever else, but I actually find that's a better approach, because I hate I would hate when people, you know, I write, spend or put all my heart and soul into something, and then someone throws it back at me and says, can you do a little bit more of a thing with it? And you go, what? What do you want? What do you want me to do with my art? Just do something with it. But that's my attitude.
I'll have to print it out first.
I find it frustrating when I get things sent back, and it's like, I want you to completely rewrite it with more of a thing in it. Because that's why it was. I mean, if you look at the Seeds of Death, is a classic example of Brian Hales was given 6 episodes to write. He did them all fine. And then Terrence Dick says, I need you to rewrite it with this thing in it. So he did. And then Terrence Dick said, no, I need to rewrite you this. And he said, bugger off. Or basically, he went on holiday, he wasn't available, so Terrence Dick had to rewrite it.
I like Seeds of Death, though.
I hate it. It's a long, tedious, repeated awfulness. The only thing
I like it. It's a classic, and I refuse to hear otherwise.
The only thing for me that makes it any enjoyable is Patrick Troughton. If Patrick Troughton is not in an episode, it's awful.
No. There's Patrick Troughton. There's there's the Ice Warriors on the moon, and there's that really nervous, twitchy guy. He's great. He is a great guy to be the only guy left in the room with the Ice Warriors, because he folds. You know, like a house of cards. It's fantastic.
I hate it. I just hate it because it's waffly and repetitive.
What about all the balloon and foam scenes? You know, oh my word.
That's only funny foam. Because of that DVD extra.
The smoke of foam. Oh, Jamie, oh my word.
There's an awful lot of foam. And yes, that is a lot of fun. But generally, I find it awful. But yeah, so a producer can do a lot for a show. Actually, funny enough, it still astounds me that during the Patrick Troughton era, the same problem that JNT had happened, which is the fact that audience figures were dropping and people were actually saying, this is crap. As the last season of Patrick Troughton went through, people were saying, this is awful. The things like the invasion was awful and the Mind Robber was awful. It was getting very, very low in its popularity.
Well, those stories I think were good, but there was a lot of crap at the same time, and a revitalization of the production team with the right people saved it. And I just don't think JNT was the right person. They must have been able to find someone better than that.
Not from my understanding. I know that just generally finding writers was difficult enough at that point.
I think they just didn't care. I mean, if they couldn't find anyone, they weren't trying hard enough. They just didn't care about it.
Well, that was the BBC attitude at the time, that basically it was too much like hard work. It was just a show they had. Because, I mean, everything back then was just a process. At that time, it still had the attitude of being like a public service. It was basically BBC executives were treating it much like the ABC, or even worse, SBS. You know, that sort of, or PBS, if you want me to Americanize my waffle. But that's what, it wasn't until Michael Grade came in that was basically, well, this is your national flagship channel that everyone watches, and basically it's the equivalent of, you know, Channel 31, or, you know, Rick and Des Do Gardening or something like that on a PBS channel. And so he had to spruce it up. But that was the thing.
Doctor Who is the equivalent of Rick and Des Do Gardening?
I was just saying the channel as a whole.
Oh,
but yes.
Okay.
Rick, in my imagination, that I imagine in sort of corporate view, the BBC was like those sort of really dodgy community TV shows. Like, hello, hello, hello. And we're Rick, and I'm Des, and we're going to do some gardening. Here is the garden. Watching me garden it. Because they're Daleks as well. Watch me garden it! Watch me garden it!
Well, speaking of Daleks, actually, yeah. 1 week until Asylum of the Daleks, I believe.
Yes, at point of recording.
And it's supposed to feature every single model of Dalek that has ever been.
Yes, and I noticed that it seems to have an excessive amount of the RTD era Daleks, which always makes me happy. I'm actually quite
probably because there was such a backlash against the you know Pride Daleks that Stephen Moffat made.
Yeah, well, he didn't make them, but
the Power Rangers Daleks. No, but he approved them. He oversaw the process.
But he, as he's often admitted in some interviews, he's not, unlike Russell T, he's not a visual person. He actually lets other people do things. Going, yeah, that's all right. Whereas he's much more of the, you know, that's he likes to out clever himself with dialogue. Whereas Russell T, I mean, you can see in the wonderful book that was written, The Writer's Tale, that he's a visual person. He will draw. I mean, his comics, his drawings are brilliant. And that's, he had a much more visual perception of what things should look like.
So, it's not so much a perception of what things should look like as a perception of what things shouldn't look like. And seeing one of those Daleks, seeing, you know, in fact, the entire array of Daleks, something should have triggered at the back of his head that, that said, I'm not scared. These don't look threatening. They look like the Power Rangers.
But that's, but that didn't. Some people don't have that. I mean, he often cites that his favorite Daleks are from the Dalek films, which are large, colorful things.
Oh no, I like those Daleks. Those Daleks look good. There's a difference between them, though. The different, there's, you know, one of the main differences is that the you know new paradigm Daleks look hunchbacked for a start. The proportions are wrong. They look like they're hunched over. They look too blocky. But also because the colors are all right, but you've got to do some work to make them look a bit menacing rather than just, you know, a rainbow mural.
The only I actually don't mind the colors. It's the fact that, especially having seen some close up in primarily in the when I went to see the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra do the Doctor Who soundtrack. Which was the Australian equivalent of the proms, the Doctor Who proms. And the problem with them is that they look horrendously plastic. That's the issue with them. Whereas the classic, the RTD ones look what they should be, metallic. They look metally. They look like they're battle-y things. Whereas the Paradigm Daleks do look like they're entirely plastic, which is probably
plastic
one of the
toys.
But I think, I know the reasons that they were designed, like, for instance, if you look at the back of the new Paradigm Daleks, they've got this sort of slat thing. The idea is that they're supposed to have new weaponry and new things that would be revealed later on. They've got more tricks up their sleeve.
Maybe see them in a week's time.
Oh, maybe. I'm not sure, but I'm not defending them, but nonetheless, they are, they're not the greatest, but I mean, that's
there were
just
reasons.
There were reasons. But nonetheless, I am looking, I'm actually genuinely excited. Maybe it is because there will be classic Daleks in there. Maybe they're
yeah, me too. What happened you say, no, do you reckon they're going to have Jeff the stupid Dalek among their array of Daleks?
Every Dalek
ever made?
Yeah. bugger.
Or Daleks that just sort of spin round in the corner going, oh my god, I have made a mistake, self-destruct.
Well, I think that's Stephen Moffat, isn't it?
What, Stephen Moffat spins around the corner going, self-destruct.
I made a mistake. I would genuinely lose my shit if there was a Dalek that was trying to count. But the thing is, that's where the new series have got it right. They've not made Daleks a joke. And that was the worst thing that they could have ever done. The thing that I had issue with Daleks, especially in the 80s, but also as far back as Destiny of the Daleks. Even earlier than that. I think I would quote here not so much the chase. I'm thinking more Death to the Daleks onwards. When you start putting the Doctor at the same status level as the Daleks, they're no longer a threat. If the Doctor doesn't fear them, then the Daleks are pointless.
The Doctor doesn't fear them anymore, though. Stephen Moffat's taken an idea that Russell T. Davies came up with, the idea that the Doctor is a little bit self-aware of his own invincible qualities. Russell T. Davies had that, but made it work. He toned it down. Stephen Moffat has done that, and just had the Doctor parading around going, hey, take your best shot, I'm the Doctor, what do you think's going to happen?
But that's that also happened in those dreadful, I want to say Broadway? No, Manhattan bloody episodes. Because at every second moment, it's like, just kill me! Oh, shut up.
Davies kept it at a minimum, and even though Manhattan, those Daleks in Manhattan stories weren't great, that he sort of kept that attitude at a reasonable level, whereas Moffat has just, he's turned everything up to 11. He's also turned up the Doctor's wacky British quirkiness, to which I think was to pander to an American audience, basically.
That reminds me, on a side note, I have not found anyone apart from the group of us in the lab. Maybe it's us. Maybe we generated this feeling. But there's I've not met many other people that hated the last Christmas special as much as we did.
Oh, well, for listeners, David, myself, and a bunch of friends were over at my place last Christmas, and we watched it. And we admittedly were a couple of bottle of wines down. And it was just awful. I haven't had the courage to rewatch it.
No, I just think it was so awful. Maybe if I watched it again, maybe it would be better, but there's something about it. Like, for instance, I rewatched The Christmas Carol, and I think that is a phenomenally great...
It's great, isn't it? It's amazing.
That I loved. But the last one, the Doctor, the whatever,
the, doctor,
and
the
whatever.
Witch in the Wardrobe.
Or whatever it was.
Yeah. Oh, I can't believe, I mean, among many, many other things, I can't believe they went to the trouble of hiring an actor as talented as Bill Bailey and then wasted him with 2 seconds worth of screen time.
Well, yes. But, you know, that's the case that they have. It's just awful.
Yep. Agreed.
Awful.
There were good. There were good things.
A lot of people love it. A lot of people love it. They go, "Oh, but the ending." Shut up! It's crap. Stop having your own crappy opinion.
There were good things in it. It's not like there were no good ideas, but it was just so poorly executed and so saccharine. You know, so clingy and maudlin. No.
No, it makes me cross. Just thinking about it. I don't want to think about it anymore. It makes me cross.
I like it when you're cross. The whole point of this show is me trying to wind you up so that you say something ridiculous.
I'll give you... Ridiculous? More like pheasant on a dog.
There we are.
But the status and Daleks and things like that, like, by the time we get to Colin Baker in Revelation of the Daleks, which, mind you, is one of my favourite stories of the Colin Baker era. I love it. Love it, love it, love it. He's getting to a point where, oh, yes, you again, Ma. Yes, well, I'll just go and parade around and talk to you and blah, 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 blah. Destiny of the Daleks.
Oh,
the
well.
Doctor's basically like, he's like, ah, well, you're a bunch of crap, aren't you?
Call yourselves the superior species.
Yeah, try climbing up after us. And it's just, oh, what's the point of them then? They just become the joke. And also by that stage, the Daleks that were in were basically the same Daleks that were made from the 60s but repainted, so they're all falling apart and it looks embarrassing.
I think they managed to resuscitate them a little bit with Remembrance of the Daleks, the Seventh Doctor story, which I think is superb.
I think that, yeah, most of it was, well, oh, actually, yeah, sorry, that story has good bits except for the Daleks.
Are you the one
Daleks
who hates the Dalek with the baseball scene? You are, aren't you?
No, I think it's great. No, I love that. I love that immensely. It's great fun. Who are you calling small is wonderful, and she bursts through the window. It's great. No, the thing I dislike about it is whenever they put Daleks outside...
Oh, they wobble. They wobble down the street.
Oh, it's painful to watch because they're slow, slow moving, and they wobble because they put new wheels on them to try and make them work outside. And it's awful.
You need a Dalek with suspension, right?
Basically, or you just go and it's worthwhile just laying tracks down. I mean, that's what they
did. Like they did with Death to the Daleks, that other wonderful Dalek story. I watched that again recently because it came out on DVD. I know we reviewed it a couple of months ago, but it's come out on DVD since then. And I flipped out. It's great. It looks beautiful. The colors are so vivid and the picture is crisp and it is such a great story. I will back this one again and again and again. And it has the isolated soundtrack, so you can get all your authentic Dalek bum 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 bum.
Folks, there's better things to spend your money on.
There aren't. I hate to break it to you. High quality television. starring John Pertwee and, according to Terry Nation, some random girl.
Oh, God. It's just... It's one that we'll continuously disagree with. Actually, I'll tell you what, speaking of continuous disagree, I have not rewatched Timelash since I last saw it. I should try it again.
Well, I confess I bought the DVD and watched it just because I wanted something to be angry at. It's shit. It's not as bad as I remember it, but it is quite bad.
Oh, yeah. There's horrible moments. Overall, it's a mess. But I think I remember having fun through it.
I didn't have fun though. I don't like Herbert. The plot has absolutely no suspense. It's just juggling a bunch of ideas that don't really fit together. Something I didn't realize until I watched this, the second episode ran under. So the reason there's so much waffle and the reason there's this second ending tacked on where the Doctor just says, ha 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 ha, I'll explain later, is because they'd run under and they needed to film like an extra 10 minutes.
That doesn't surprise me. Look, I think if I rewatched it again, I probably would be like more angry at it. But I just still remember vaguely enjoying it. But you know, that's weird. But then again, you know, you like the gunfighters, so.
Oh my God! Yes, I showed that to an American who liked it. People are on my side.
Uh huh. Rightio.
I even like the ballad, Last Chance Saloon. Oh, I love me some ballad.
I think if I watched it again, I might find it stomachable, but I just remember hating it on its first watch.
I've got to the point in my life where I just want to have the Ballad of the Last Chance Saloon on as I break open the bottle of wine, turn down the lights, and turn on my seduction face. Would you not be wooed by the Ballad of the Last Chance Saloon?
I've got this weird picture now. In a sort of Silence of the Lambs quality, as you're playing the Last Chance Saloon, as you go, would you fuck me? I would fuck me.
I have on order, and have had on order for about 3 or 4 months now, Blue Box Boy, Matthew Waterhouse's autobiography, Matthew Waterhouse being the sterling superlative actor who played Adric in the 1980s.
He was an instance where, and I think... I remember reading the Eric Saywood interview in Doctor Who magazine. Eric Saywood often said he couldn't imagine why Matthew Waterhouse was employed, but was told he did a really good audition. And he said that he only realized how that could happen when he sat through the audition of Bonnie Langford. And Bonnie Langford's audition was actually really, really good. So, and then people go, oh my God, why on earth would they hire her?
I'm going to disagree. I think Bonnie Langford was a reasonable actress. I think she might have been miscast in Doctor Who. But, you know, it's not like she's a bad actress. It's not like she's doing a terrible job. Whereas Matthew Waterhouse is and has never done a good job in his entire life. And I always read that statement that he did a good job in the audition as John Nathan Turner wanted his pants. Because we're talking about a young, nubile, reasonably good-looking actor. I'm not saying he was a supermodel, but I think he was John Nathan Turner's type. That is the only way I can explain how Matthew Waterhouse was cast.
I kind of mentioned anyone being his type, but you know, I suppose absolute sycophants would be.
Yeah, well, so I've heard.
Well, you're right about Bonnie Langford. I think that she is, but I think she was poorly directed. She was given all this backstory, I believe, but was never used, and she was just sort of directed to be her panto version.
Well, same with Perry, actually.
If you listen to her in the audios, she's magnificent.
Because Perry's supposed to be a botanist, Mel's supposed to be a computer programmer. I think it was the John Nathan Turner era where he just wanted generic screamy women and didn't bother about developing their characters.
Yeah.
Whereas at least, I mean, other female companions, you know, they never developed their characters either, but they at least had some personality that they brought to it. Sarah Jane Smith acted sort of like a journalist. She was always snooping around. Even someone like Zoe, who was supposed to be a computer programmer, she acted that part. They never really brought it up much, but she acted the hell out of it.
But to be fair, we also still get clunker stories, because there was some where Elizabeth Slater even admits that she's sort of really had to do something with her role, because a lot of it was just arse.
And probably death to the Daleks.
Yeah, oh god. But yeah, so, you know, Blue Box Boy...
Oh yeah, I believe the publisher's having a bit of a heart murmur because they're not selling anything at the moment. That book's been on order for 4 months now.
Right.
But I am looking forward to reading that with a vengeance, and I will report back when it finally arrives.
Yeah, I was about to say surely it would have sold by now, but, you know, some fans would go for it, I don't know. I'd love to see if he mentions anything about his history, like, you know, with his Hamleting and whatever
else. You know it's written in the third person, right?
No.
This is why Philip Sandifer described it as an interesting document.
Oh, so he has purchased it, he has read it.
Yes, no, it's been published for a while, but when I ordered a copy from the publisher, I think they're having a bit of a moment, like someone had a brain explosion, and for the past couple of months they haven't been shipping anything.
Right.
But it's written in the third person. Where do you get off? How do you arrive at the decision of writing an autobiography in the third person, unless you're Julius Caesar?
Maybe he is. Maybe.
I suspect he thinks Matthew he Waterha- is.
Maybe Matthew Waterhouse, if you were to do his genealogy, is actually a direct descendant of Caligula. He may have gone out. He may not have married a horse, but he could be horse hung.
I'm sorry? Now who's perving on Matthew Waterhouse? I want to read for our wonderful listeners the Matthew Waterhouse review in Hamlet. Or would you like to take this one?
Oh, yes, this is the quote only. So this is from Time Out's review of Matthew Waterhouse in Hamlet. But it is only with the appearance of Hamlet himself, Matthew Waterhouse, that we fully realize what abysmal treasures lie in store. Only the installation of Chris Eubank, opera producer Peter Sellers, the Queen Mother, Boris Karloff, or Sonia in the role of the Prince of Denmark could outdo the casting misdemeanor here. From what I can gather, Mr. Waterhouse has actually three cardboard cutouts, looking left, looking right, and fists clenched
for madness.
He makes his entrances and exits in the guise of Robo-Ham, a high-precision theatrical instrument that stalks around the stage in a perfect straight line without even the tiniest hint of expression. All this is topped off by a decidedly unprincely wooden gait and the classic countenance of your average computer boffin. And so the moral complexities of Shakespeare's plays are overtaken by a couple of entirely new and original concerns. Can a side of mutton really go mad? Is it feigning madness? And who cares, anyway?
Bravo.
Oh, man.
This review gives me such tingles in my happy place. It never ceases to amaze, and I can't wait to read his book. And I'm being forced to, though. I've got quite into some of the, Doctor Who Perry publications around Doctor Who, like Sharda and the Elizabeth Sladen's autobiography.
Yes, Elizabeth Sladen's autobiography is quite good. It's good to get new information, like how John Pertwee was steering her on set.
Well, yeah, that's true. Now, the best stuff she had was recounting her experiences with others on Doctor Who, but she doesn't have much of her own personality, I think. And that comes out in the commentaries as well.
Yeah. What was she saying about other people?
Oh, not other people. Talking about John Pertwee, talking about the production, talking about what happened to her, but not talking about how she felt or what she did so much.
Right. Well, yeah, I think that's just, you know, because I know, well, that would explain a lot, because she was a very private person. I mean, only about three people in the whole world knew she had cancer, so that would kind of explain her personality.
Really? You reckon she's just, like, she had a lot of personality, it was just private?
Oh, she was horrendously private. She really closed off. Nobody really knew the inner workings of her.
Wow. Okay, I take it back. Maybe she did have a lot of personality. She just didn't let it out much or show it much.
Quite possibly. Well, on that note, I think it must be the end of the podcast. But until next time, well, hopefully you may have gone and grabbed the Planet of Giants, or maybe I have and I have to have it observed. Maybe you can finally get your Blue Box Boy.
Ew. I hope I don't have to clean him off first.
But until then, I have been David Innes.
I've been St. John Carp.
And this was the Carnival of Bastards.